You're listening to All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Time again for a look back at the week in North Carolina politics, where voices from the right and left offer perspective and discussion. Becky Gray is with the conservative John Locke Foundation, and Rob Schofield works with the liberal North Carolina Justice Center. Good to see you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
State senators gave final approval to their version of the budget early this morning. It's a $22.9 billion spending plan that grows government by 2.5% and, among other provisions, adds $600 million for education, puts roughly 61% of the state surplus into a savings fund, and includes the latest round of significant tax cuts. There is plenty in this multi-hundred-page document. Let's start briefly with a best and a worst provision from each of you. Rob.
Wow. I give this budget an F. I think it is a dishonest budget. It's an insidious budget. It purports to spend more on government, but it doesn't really. Core services are actually losing out. The growth in spending is all about inflation and population growth. It really doesn't put money into any of the program. It adopts the language, we're doing things for education, we're doing things for early childhood, for higher ed. But if you look behind the big picture talking points and look at the actual numbers, these programs are all taking new hits, they're suffering, and we're going to continue to retreat as a state. So I can't even pick out one. There's so many bad ones.
358 pages. That's just the policy piece of it. There's not one provision or one thing you
okay.
would point to and say that.
How about the fact that we are going to put a moratorium on wind farms, a proposal that we never even discussed before, to my knowledge, in a committee, and that's just jammed in the bill at the last minute, along with dozens of other special provisions that were never discussed in committee, no process whatsoever, and now they're going to, if the House agrees to it, that'll be law of the state.
More money for teachers, anything you like, anything that you say, all right, I can accept that, I can use that as a starting point to move forward during these next few weeks of budget negotiations.
Well, more money for teachers is good, but we used to talk about growth in that kind of spending, which is basically about the growth in education spending is basically about our growth in our student population. A little bit money, more money for teachers, that's fine, but it's still way short of where we need to be. Education continues to suffer. I'm really struggling. I'm trying to find something that I think is good about this budget. There are individual programs, I suppose, that are doing better, that perhaps some of the things that Governor Cooper asked for that are some of his requests were honored. But there's so many decisions to target individual employees and fire them, insert all these special provisions, cut spending in all kinds of essential public services and structures, and to package it all with a big new tax cut for the wealthy it's just really one of the worst budgets I've seen in years.
Becky, a best and a worst.
I've got three best things, really. Tax cuts, savings, and prudent spending. With the tax cuts, over a couple of years, there's about $1 billion in tax cuts. And what that means is North Carolinians need to get to keep more of their money. That's for teachers, that's for state employees, that's for every single one of us. These tax cuts are a reduction in the personal income rate. So everybody that pays personal income gets a tax cut. 94,000 people are actually moved off the tax rolls entirely with the increase of the standard deduction, that zero tax bracket, if you will. So, we keep hearing this is a tax cut only for millionaires. I just, the math just doesn't bear that out. Everybody gets a tax cut. 99% of North Carolinians will see either paying no taxes or a significant tax cut. I think that's a big deal. I think it's a respect for hardworking North Carolina families. Now, the second thing that I really like is savings. They have put $363 million in savings. This is significant. We saw this with Hurricane Matthew when that came through. Luckily, they had done this last year, shored up the savings accounts so that when we have a natural disaster, there's some money there. The other thing this will do, Jeff, is this will give us some sort of cushion and protection should the economy turn around. Actually, not should the economy take a downturn, when the economy takes a downturn. We didn't have this in 2008, and there were dire measures put into place to try to dig out of that recession. If we've got that money in savings, we've got that to fall back on so that we can continue to pay teachers. We don't have to furlough state employees like we saw Governor Beverly Perdue do during that recession when it was hit. That's why the savings is so significant. 8.7% of our state budget will go into the savings account. So again, if you think about your personal personal budgeting, sitting around your kitchen table, making one of the things that you want to do is you want to make sure you've got enough savings there so that if something happens unexpectedly, you can still function and provide for your family and those kind of things. That's what this budget does.
Rob, I want you to respond.
I'm wincing. The math doesn't work. It's not right. You can say you're taking some people off the income tax rolls, Becky, but the vast majority of people who are low and middle income pay their taxes in property taxes and in sales taxes. The income tax cuts for the low and middle class people are going to amount to nothing, a few bucks. Thousands and thousands of dollars will be cut from the income tax bills of people at the top and profitable corporations. And we're going to blow a $600 million hole in the budget within the next couple of years, according to the legislature's own staff, based upon this proposal. So the notion that this is prudent or that it somehow benefits everybody is just simply absurd. It's not true. And the notion of a rainy day fund or savings account, it's raining now. We weren't able to give a cost of living adjustment to retirees. The bill has a proposal to stop giving retirement benefits to new state employees. I mean, the list just goes on and on. It is another shift of income away from people at the middle and the bottom to people at the top, and a disinvestment in essential public structures and services that will continue to suffer.
10 to 12 years ago, the standard deduction for individuals and couples filing jointly, I believe, it was $3,000 and $6,000.
Right.
We're looking now at $18,000 to $20,000.
Exactly.
And the corporate rate has dropped significantly.
Right.
It's going to be down under this proposal.
6.9% to 3%.
And
even further if this proposal goes
under
through.
This. Mm-hmm. So my question pertaining to taxes and tax levels, where's the ideal level from your perspective? Are we going to a zero tax game? Are we trying to be like New Hampshire
not.
Or Texas?
No, of course not.
But where does it?
I think we're still getting there. But, Jeff, I think, too, it's important to focus not only on the tax rates, but other things that have happened in North Carolina, and that is rolling back regulations, opening up markets so that businesses can create jobs, so they can get people back to work rather than being dependent on the government, making smart investments in things that we know work, in infrastructure, in transportation, so that just, you know, imagine the state as, you know, the map with a lot of activity going on. That's what you want to do. So, yes, these tax reductions are important. That's what brings people to North Carolina. That's what brings businesses to North Carolina. Businesses are the ones that create jobs, that employ people, that get people to work, that they're able to have the confidence and be fully employed and take care of themselves rather than looking to government to take care of them.
A provision in this budget that you do not like?
I do not like the continuation of economic incentives. There is money in there for the film grants. I don't know why we're giving special targeted benefits to the film company at the exclusion of other industries. There's also some those economic incentive corporate welfare programs. In my mind, the better way, kind of circling back to this, the better way to incentivize businesses is to keep the tax rate low, provide good infrastructure, good investments in education, a well-skilled workforce, rather than these targeted giveaways where government uses government power to pick winners and losers. So, that has gone on. It's gone on under Democrats, under Republicans. There is a continuation of this in this budget. And so if I had to go in with my red pen, that would be what I would take out.
There are about 600,000 retired state employees and teachers in this state. COLA is the acronym that we use here in this political bubble, cost of living adjustment. Since 2009, state retirees have received a total, not each year, but a total of a 2% increase cost of living adjustment. Any concerns with that?
And that was not addressed in this budget. There is no cost of living increase
right,
for retirees.
Right.
Yeah, so that is a concern. I think it's something that we need to look at. But at the same time, going back to this, if you think of the big economic picture, those retirees are all going to benefit from the tax cuts that have put into place. So that's something else. And the other thing, Jeff, that we really need to look at and focus on, and I know this General Assembly is looking at it, is to shore up that pension plan to ensure that it is in place and to put money aside and invest in that pension plan so that is available and stable for the retirees so they do get the pension. Now, I agree that a cost of living certainly is in order. I hope that the House will consider that. But, right now I think shoring up that pension plan and the state health plan is another thing. Retirees get the state health plan as well. Their health insurance is covered by the state. So those are benefits. The cost of living is kind of aside from that.
Rob, you're writing notes over there. I'll let you loose.
I mean, on the cost of living, obviously that should have been done years ago. It is a testament to this persistent disinvestment in essential services and structures. I mean, that's just a bare minimum kind of thing we should be doing. We ought to probably even be raising their pensions. Instead, they're getting 2%, as you say, over 8 or 9 years. And that's because we're cutting taxes on people at the top. We're shifting income, the great tax shift. We're shifting responsibility for funding government away from people at the top and onto people in the middle at the bottom who don't have the money. And if you want to talk about whether taxes are actually driving economic development, it's just not true. North Carolina's economic growth is among the lowest in the Southeast. If you look at states like Washington and California, which have much higher tax rates, they're building new businesses, developing new businesses like crazy, much faster than North Carolina. So it's just a fallacy, this notion that taxes play some significant role in driving economic development in our state. Our state was number one for economic, you know, for whatever, Site Selection magazine under the Democrats. It's when taxes were significantly higher than they are now. So that's just a misnomer that has anything to do with it.
I would really disagree. The economic growth of North Carolina it's just unquestionable. When you look at GDP, when you look at unemployment rates, when you look at additional revenue, we have a revenue surplus in North Carolina of $580 million. We're one of, I think, two or three states in the country that have a surplus. I mean, clearly, Rob may disagree with a lot of the policies that are put into place, but the facts are North Carolina's economy is stronger. It is recovering quicker and faster than our neighbors and other states across the country. So, you know, and there are other things in play with this. I mean, what we see is the nation as a whole is digging its way out of this recession. But North Carolina is ahead of the other players. And so these things are working. We know they're working. People are getting back to work. And so, you know, all of these gloom and doom proclamations from the left just, you know, that is not the fact of the matter.
We'll have a debate over numbers, but it is actually true that North Carolina's growth is slower than the rest of the Southeast in the last couple of years. And the notion that these tax cuts that the General Assembly has implemented in the last several years and Governor McCrory have had anything to do with developing our state's economy, it's just patently false.
I don't know where you're getting your data, but the things like unemployment,
GDP,
per capita income, all of those things that real economists use to measure these things.
I think we disagree on your numbers, too. The economy is moving.
Yeah, we'll table it for now, and I think this would be a good place to come back to because on the right, I think that the general, I don't mean to oversimplify, but on the right, the sentiment is North Carolina's leaders, the folks in that building across the street, are leading the economic resurgence coming out of the recession. And on the left, what we hear is this is part of a national trend and that North Carolina leaders are getting too much credit for it, and this is tethered much more to the national economy. I'm not weighing in either way.
And probably there's a little bit of truth on both sides of that, to be honest with you.
We will revisit it. That's my promise here.
Sounds
okay.
Good.
Becky, Senate proposes 2.5% growth in spending. This comes on the heels 2 months ago. The governor, Roy Cooper, proposed a budget of 5.1%, a budget that Rob, I believe, here in this room called modest. Has the governor done a good job of setting himself up to perhaps be more in line with a House budget proposal that we're going to see in the weeks to come?
You know, that's an interesting point, and I'm not sure that was in the governor's mind when he was putting his budget together, but that may actually be the reality of it. The number to, I think, pay attention to is inflation plus population. What is that number this year? It's 3.8%. So actually, with the 2.5% on the Senate side and a 5.1% on the governor's side, that 3.8%, which is the growth of population plus inflation, may very well be more in the neighborhood of where we end up. But on the governor's budget, too, I think it's interesting to note that many of the priorities in the governor's budget really reflect the priorities that the Senate budget has. It's just a different spending level, if you will, for many of those things. But the governor talked about savings. He had savings in his budget. He talked about tax relief for the middle class. The Senate really put that in place. But a lot of things, investments in education, investments in infrastructure. So the governor's budget and the Senate budget, if you sort of list out what the priorities are, they really look very similar. Now, the way they fund those things, there are, 3% difference in that.
Rob, Democrats don't have much power. We know this. The concerted effort by Senate Democrats Thursday night was to highlight the differences again and again and again between the Senate proposal and the governor's proposal. What'd you make of that strategy?
Well, that's about all they can do, I think, at this point. That was probably a reasonable one. And I agree that we're likely to see some improvement in the House budget. I think it is really instructive that the Senate is not, that the Senate budget doesn't even keep up with population, as by Becky's numbers, with population growth and inflation. So that's a sign that the Senate sort of likes to adopt the governor's language. They realize the governor's got a good message about let's invest in education, let's help people, you know, who are struggling. And they've adopted that language, but they haven't actually backed it up with money. So it'll be interesting to see if the House does a little bit better job in that. I expect they probably will. But the bottom line is it's still going to be an inadequate budget, whatever we come up with here, it sounds like. It looks like even if we get up to that inflation plus population growth, that still means that when you factor in the fact of rising health care costs and other things that are beyond the control of the General Assembly, that means we're cutting other areas of essential services. There's no way to get around it. The math doesn't work out unless you do that. So bottom line is it's another year of an austerity budget in a time when we could be repairing the damage from the last several years.
I just would argue that there's still room to streamline and make the government, make the budget, make the way state government works more efficient, more accountable, and we continue to move towards that. I don't think we're there yet. I don't think that we should go in and slash government by, 6% or whatever that is. But, this is one thing that we've seen over the years is that this General Assembly has looked at specific parts of government and made adjustments where they feel like the taxpayer money is best spent to get the results that we want to fill the essential roles of government.
Looking ahead, crystal ball, getting ahead of ourselves, admittedly, what do you expect the big issues to be between the House and Senate? Recognizing the governor has made a proposal that is largely symbolic, the power rests in these two chambers. I'm looking at tax policy and also, I think, on a secondary level, raise the age as a key bargaining chip. But what are you all looking at?
Yeah, I think those are important ones. I'm very hopeful that the House will take a more reasonable approach towards taxes and spending and not go down this road of slashing taxes still further. I'm hopeful that they will work to fund raise the age. This debate we're having over when North Carolina's become the last state to raise the age for prosecution from 16 to 18 to prosecute someone as an adult. But the Senate is saying, well, let's just do that for misdemeanors. Let's not do that for felonies. I think that, maybe we'll get there. I'm hopeful that'll be a distinct. And I'm also hopeful that the House will remove some of these very specific targeting of individual state employees over in Department of Environmental Quality, Department of Public Instruction, where the Senate's really getting down to the level of telling people who to hire and fire in state government. I'm really hopeful that the House will stand up and say that's not how we should run a railroad, and maybe even remove some of these provisions from the budget that have never been discussed before, that were just slipped in at the last minute in the dark of night. I'm really hopeful that the House will take a more open, transparent approach to the process. I don't know. I'm not overly optimistic about it, but I'm hopeful.
I think that the tax issue is going to be probably the biggest thing they're going to have to find consensus on. The Senate plan, again, over several years is about a $1 billion tax cut. The House has talked about a tax reduction plan. Theirs is about $400 million. So there's a difference.
Yeah.
There's a difference there that they're going to have to come. Now, one thing that's helpful is when the House was initially talking about their tax cuts, we didn't have all the revenue numbers in. We didn't know that after the April surprise, if you will, that there was $580 million in surplus. So I think now just having more of the concrete numbers to move forward with will have some impact on that. But I think that's clearly going to be one where there's going to be some negotiating going on. I agree with Rob on raise the age, trying juvenile 16 and 17-year-olds as juveniles rather than putting them in adult court. I was really happy to see in the Senate budget that they did set aside for that raise the age. There was no money for it. And, of course, with any of this, we know if there's going to be additional cost, you have to allow for that. The House is in the process of getting a bill through that does, there's some changes to the specifics of it, but it does have the funding attached to it. So I think that we'll see those two things come together. The other thing is the Senate had something I was very pleased with in the Senate budget was repeal certificate of need laws across the board for everything. The Senate has really taken a serious look. Actually, the General Assembly has taken a serious look at how do you reduce health care costs, how do you ensure access in all areas of North Carolina. Removing those certificate of need requirements is one way to do that. The Senate has a complete certificate of need repeal in that budget. I think that that's another negotiating point there. We may see some adjustments. We may see repeal for certain things like perhaps mental health services, repealing certificate of need to get those services and those beds in the places that we need them. And the other thing that I hope that they will both come together on, the one really important thing, and I think this is a really significant thing in the budget, is a transparency portal that would have a web portal that every state agency, every university, every school system would have online basically their checkbook posted in a way that regular people like me and Rob that don't have advanced degrees in computer engineering and all, that we can go and look at those things. I think it is extremely important to have that available, that accountability, that transparency. You know, we talk about where we think this money ought to go and where it ought not go. You know, what I'd like to see is actually where it's going, when it goes, how it goes, those kind of things. Sunshine is the very best disinfectant, and I think just having that transparency portal available is a hugely important policy issue.
Quick follow-up. Should that start with legislators and the General Assembly?
Exactly.
The General Assembly, absolutely. I mean, the General Assembly is a state agency. Of course it would be on there. Every state agency, I think what they did, if I understand it correctly, and of course we're still digging through the language in here, it would be everything except they would encourage the cities and counties to do it, but I think they're giving them a little bit of a time to get their IT stuff, you know, in place. This was actually put in the 2015 budget, and it was never actually implemented. There was some funding in 2015, but this puts, actually the first thing it does is it requires a report to say this was put in place in 2015, why wasn't it done? And the second thing is we're going to do it now, and here's the money to do it. And I think that's a huge policy advancement.
All I can say is the irony of the Senate purporting to tell people about transparency. I mean, they passed this 800-page budget they dumped on everybody's desk at midnight that people hadn't read and gave them a couple of hours to digest it, and then wouldn't even let amendments be offered on several of the provisions.
So does this mean you don't like the transparency portal?
Are you opposing that?
It's
fine, Becky, but of course it's absurd to pass a transparency portal in the dark of night, and it's emblematic of how the Senate talks a good game.
When did you get the budget? When did you get the budget? It was posted online. I found the transparency portal within like 10 minutes of getting the budget. So, you know, come on.
Oh, come on, yeah, 10 minutes to digest an 800-page budget. Becky, you know that's not the discussion here. The discussion is that this is emblematic of a Senate that talks a good game. It talks about things like transparency. It talks about things like helping teachers. Of course.
Okay.
It talks about helping teachers, but the notion of passing it in this way is absurd. And it points to the
irony. I mean, we're all cracking a smile. Our listeners can't see
that. I mean, the irony of that is absurd.
Do you find a little irony in the Senate doing that in the way they have?
I don't agree with Rob that all of this was done behind closed doors. If you've been paying attention, if you've been going to the committee meetings,
they haven't had a committee meeting for a month.
If you've been reading the bills as they've been proposed, most of these things are out there. They've been there. You know, if you're paying attention, you know, you've done it. Now, you know, did somebody call you when the budget came out and said, Rob, let me spoon feed you this? There's a certain responsibility.
If I were a legislator, the least I could expect would to have maybe a week to read the budget, to have individual provisions debated in committee and not just slipped into the budget in the middle of the night, 800 pages. We got provisions in there taking away the right of judges to waive court fees for poor people. That was never discussed in a committee.
Like they did when the Democrats were in charge?
Absolutely. It was outrageous then, and it's doubly outrageous now.
Okay, we agree on that.
It's doubly outrageous now because
at least in this— But if you're going to be critical of the whole process and the system. You know, it's not just the Republicans. It's not just this General Assembly. There's a lot of things that I think we would agree on that as far as process at the General Assembly, you know, this has gone on for decades and things need to change.
You're absolutely right there, but it has gotten much worse. Just like gerrymandering, which was done under the Democrats, it has gotten exponentially worse under Republicans. The fact that we can't even have amendments offered on different provisions that they just don't accept them. You can't take money from one item and put them into the other.
This is nothing new.
But you agree it's outrageous, right?
Of course
it
is. Okay. But to point fingers at this General Assembly.
This General Assembly has been in power for 7 years now, Becky. They haven't made one improvement in this area. If anything, it's gotten worse and worse, and we've got to do something about it.
I don't agree it's gotten worse. I think it's exactly the same. And, you know, you're right. It does need to change, and groups like mine have advocated for good government changes and transparency. That's why I wanted to make a point to bring up this transparency portal. I think that's a good thing. I think it's a real advancement. I hope that it was something we've been advocating at the John Locke Foundation for years, and I was delighted to see that it's moving forward in the General Assembly.
We will call this mile 12 of the budget marathon. We will be talking for a few more weeks and perhaps months as spring rolls into summer. Rob Schofield is Director of Research at NC Policy Watch, part of the North Carolina Justice Center. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Thank you both.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, guys.
To hear an extended version of this conversation, visit our website, wunc.org.